Hi, I'm Armin Alney, host of To the Point in Which Way LA, and thanks so much for listening to our programs. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film awards season, I've got a podcast for you to check out. It's called The Treatment, hosted by Elvis Mitchell. He goes beyond the plot to understand what inspires the actors, the filmmakers, the producers, and others to do what they do. You can find The Treatment on KCRW's iTunes page. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. Pope Francis continues to shake up the Vatican and the rest of the Roman Catholic world. We'll hear how the pontiff from Argentina is attempting a radical shift in focus from Europe and the U.S. to poor nations in the underdeveloped world. That's later on To the Point. First, this story. In Los Angeles, for the first time in 12 years, violent crime increased in 2014. Aggravated assaults were up 24%. LAPD Chief Charlie Beck says better record-keeping could be part of the reason. Now, the department uses the CompStat system, introduced by former Chief Bill Bratton, and the LA Times recently discovered that the number of serious violent crimes had been underreported. Is the city more dangerous? Or is there a math problem? Joel Rubin wrote the story. Hi, Joel. Good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
What about it? How was it that aggravated assaults could jump 24% in 2014? That's a big number.
It is a big number, and it's a number without a clear answer. As you said, the department, Charlie Beck and others have, as the number continued to climb and rose into the double digits, they offered two explanations. One, they said that following our investigation into the accuracy of their crime numbers, they said that they were doing a better job at more accurately classifying crime. And as they did that, the numbers went up. So it was not a reflection of a real rise in new crime, but just a more accurate accounting of crime. But they said they also were experiencing a dramatic jump in the number of domestic violence cases, which fall under the aggravated assault total. And so they said those two together explained the dramatic rise.
24% increase in aggravated assault. What about other kinds of violent crime?
Right. So when we talk about a city's violent crime total, we're talking about four different types of crime. Aggravated assaults, which are serious attacks that usually involve a weapon or result in serious injury. Robberies, rapes, and homicides. And in LA, all four categories were up this year compared to last year. Homicides were up there were four more. There were 254, which was four more than the previous year. Rapes were up double digits, about 12%. Robberies were pretty much flat, up just less than 1%. And then you had the big jump in aggravated assaults.
How long does it appear that aggravated assaults, for example, might have been underreported?
Well, unfortunately, I can't tell you that. And the reason I can't tell you that is because the department, so far at least, has declined our repeated request to hand over. We asked for 11 years of crime data to analyze the accuracy of their classifications, and also to be able to then say, okay, the department said from 1 year to the next, crime dropped this much. Well, let's evaluate those claims. To do that, obviously, you need to be able to evaluate the accuracy of their crime numbers from year to year. They only gave us data to be able to analyze 1 year's worth.
And you needed 11 years because they've been saying for 12 years that crime has been going down.
Right, exactly. They have been posting numbers which point to this remarkable streak of uninterrupted declines in crime from 1 year to the next. And they said, when we had several conversations with them as we were looking into the numbers, they said, well, our year-over-year declines are still valid. They should not come under question because we make, you know, basically the same number of mistakes from 1 year to the next. So the decline is what they've referred to as a relative decline still stands. We think we would like to take a look at the numbers ourselves to evaluate it.
Now, Chief Beck thanked you, as you indicated, for showing that they weren't doing all that great a job. Says now they're doing a better job as a result, but won't pass on the information. He and Mayor Garcetti are planning a news conference of some kind next week. What's that about?
Well, every year, the department, the police chief and the mayor, usually in the first or second week of January, have a big press conference where they review or they go over the previous year's totals. And as we've talked about, it's been usually a celebration because they get up and say, here are numbers that show yet again crime has gone down compared to the year prior. This year obviously will be a little different because they're going to have to address this rise in violent crime. Now, we should pause and say that property crimes, theft, burglaries, car thefts, that sort of thing, those numbers, according to the LAPD, were still down. And that's not to be, overlooked, because that is the majority of the types of crimes that happen in the city. But people care a lot about levels of violence, and the mayor and the chief will have to explain not only the rise in all the categories of crime, but really, I think, are going to have to answer some questions about how do they explain this dramatic rise in aggravated assault, and what does it mean?
And this has broader consequences as well, because the mayor has said he thinks other city departments ought to be using the same kind of statistical analysis that the LAPD does.
Exactly. Yeah, he has made a big point of pointing to the LAPD as a model that he wants other agencies, other departments around the city to emulate. As far as the use of data to benchmark progress and benchmark successes and identify problem areas, I think what our investigation showed is that you can have a great system in place, but unless that system includes a real vigilance as to making sure that the data goes in is accurate, then it's the worth quickly degenerates.
Joel Rubin again with the Los Angeles Times. Eli Silverman is with us. He's professor emeritus at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, and he's also co-author of The Crime Numbers Game, Management by Manipulation. Professor, good to have you on our show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Does what's happening in Los Angeles sound familiar to you?
Oh, it's extremely familiar. It follows a pattern of many cities who have mimicked the New York City Police Department's CompStat performance management system, which made a great deal of sense in the early years. But over the years, New York and now L.A., it appears, and many other cities in the U.S. and around the world have witnessed these numbers that are integral to the system become an end in themselves, and the systems have metastasized, and where there's a real incentive to keep the numbers down and most favorable. And the major way that's done is illustrated by the L.A. revelations, where you downgrade crime, you move it from the felony category, which is widely publicized, and you downgrade it, put it into the misdemeanor category, or you don't take reports. There are various ways of this manipulation, and there are many examples of this around the world. And what I find intriguing in this discussion with Mr. Rose is that the L.A. now saying it's the model, well, that seems to have followed the L.A. Times report. And the problem is, in many of these systems, including New York, is there's no outside independent evaluation of the legitimacy and the validity of these crime statistics. And this has been going on for years, despite whistleblowers, despite all kinds of reports, despite all kinds of evidence that we and others have generated, there's no outside evaluation and assessment. So we've been dependent on the police departments themselves and what they say the actual level of crime is.
You're not accusing the LAPD or other departments of intentionally manipulating the figures, are you? Are you saying that there's just pressure to keep the numbers down because, of course, it looks better?
Well, the pressure from the top in New York and many other places, the pressure from the top in these meetings where the numbers are constantly evaluated and the commanders are evaluated on their numbers this week compared to the same time, same week last year, the previous year. The pressure emanates from the top and is pushed down to the lower levels. And throughout the whole system, there are incentives to make the numbers look good. We see this in education. We see this in social work. There have been many revelations of this. So the pressures make many a commander and those under them put the best possible light on the number. So if I come into your command and say, well, my computer was stolen, you say, oh, you probably lost it. So I move it from a robbery to I move it to a stolen lost property. And this has happened. We have many accounts of this. We have whistleblowers. We have tape recordings of this. So whether this is intentional or not, those will have to decide. But in the absence of any kind of long-range independent assessment, we have to conclude that the pressures to do this are enormous, and they build up over the years, because in the early years, it's very easy to decrease crime. It's like squeezing juice from an orange. When you first start squeezing it, it's easy to extract the juice. But the more you squeeze, the tougher it is to extract juice. And that happens with keeping crime down. You have to be more and more creative, innovative, in terms of how you report the crime.
Okay. You've been talking, of course, about the New York City Police Department. That may or may not be true of what's going on in Los Angeles. You're suggesting, as I take it, that it certainly is possible. Let me introduce George Tita. He is a professor of criminology at UC Irvine, studies community policing and violent crime. It's good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Do you think this goes beyond the numbers, beyond CompStat?
In the sense that this is a concerted effort to...
Well, the increase from 24%, let's go back to that.
Okay, so let's imagine that there's some sort of bias, systematic bias, mistake-making in whether it's intentional or not in the underreporting of serious crimes. If that is random, then I think the LAPD does have some validity in terms of the first 11 years being the slope was definitely going down, and that it wasn't a change in the reporting from year to year to year to year.
And it has been going down in other cities as well.
Exactly. And we'll come back to one other thing. And then if they, quote unquote, fix it last year, then you see this huge increase, right? And I think the number of crimes that the LA Times said that were miscategorized as around 1,600, 16,000, whatever the number was, it would make this year's increase look...
1,200, I think.
Yeah, so it would make... Let's say that last year there were 1,000 crimes that should have been counted as serious. It would have a pretty significant impact on the overall increase of crime of aggravated assaults this year. What I think I would like to point to is that the homicides are down. That robberies are basically flat, I believe. That property crime is basically flat or showed some decrease. First, as Eli said, that you can't continue to get crime declines year after year after year. Crime is never going to zero. It's never going negative. So, I mean, if you look at something like homicide, yep, it increased. It went from 250 to 254 over the last year. So I think there's something wrong with the data. I think there's too much evidence that there was a categorization
okay.
problem. But if I look at the homicide, those are the ones that are really difficult to miscategorize. And I do believe L.A. is a safer city.
Okay. Joel Rubin, let me go back to you with the Los Angeles Times. You've been covering the Los Angeles Police Department for a long time. Do you think, as a result of all that we have been talking about, that there might be an independent evaluation instituted so that we could have more confidence in what they're reporting?
Well, following our following the first article that we published that had the major findings of the underreported aggravated assaults, the police commission, which is the civilian body that oversees the department, instructed its inspector general to launch a wide-ranging audit into the department's crime stats. What the parameters of that audit will be is not exactly clear. I think he's saying that it will be done and published in the next 2 to 3 months, 3 or 4 months, I think. So we'll obviously be very interested to see. He has said that he will take a look at multiple years of data, which will at least begin the discussion or begin the assessment of whether the year-over-year declines that the department has been posting are accurate. But that's not to say, you know, that's one audit. As far as going forward and having a consistent outside set of eyes looking at the data, as of now, you know, if the inspector general takes that on, it would be great. But But we would hope that the department would be more forthcoming in sharing large amounts of data with outside entities such as ourselves so that we could do the assessment.
And Professor Silverman, transparency in this matter is important, is it not?
Yeah, it's essential. You can't in any organization, you can't just rely on the organization to provide their interpretation of what they do. In order to grant legitimacy and trust, you need some kind of independent, trustworthy unit to assess this. And unless the organizations are transparent and willing to share that, in many jurisdictions, we point out in our book, this does occur. But in those that it doesn't occur, unfortunately, there are perverse incentives.
Okay. George Tita, once again at UC Irvine, what would you hope for from Mayor Garcetti and Chief Beck next week?
I think opening up and explaining where they think that the increases are being driven, or to what extent are they real increases in aggravated assaults and so forth. What has changed? If they've changed something in terms of the recording, reporting of crime, what is it that they have changed?
All right. We'll be looking for that. In the meantime, thanks to you all, George Tita at UC Irvine, Eli Silverman, his book, The Crime Numbers Game, Management by Manipulation. He's in New York City. Joel Rubin with the LA Times. Many thanks to you all.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In a moment, a new focus at the Las Vegas Consumer Electronics Show, self-driving cars on Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. The Consumer Electronics Show is underway in Las Vegas with 2.2 million square feet of exhibition space for the latest gadgets. Here's Dieter Bohn. He's executive editor at TheVerge.com. Hi, Dieter. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, great to be here.
So you have written a story that says we finally know what comes after the smartphone. What is it?
It is the Internet of Things, or since we're at a technology conference, I have to make acronyms, so everybody calls it IoT. And it's basically a shorthand for sticking computer chips and cellular radios in pretty much everything you can imagine, your coffee pot, your light bulbs, your coffee cables, and anything in your house that they can think of. They'll stick a computer chip, connect it up to the cloud, and automate something about it.
So is the whole house going to be automated then, and we can run it from someplace else if we have to?
Yeah, that's the idea. The problem is that having lots and lots of things being hooked up to computers is difficult because they all need to communicate with each other. And so, you know, with the smartphones, the big fight was between, you know, is it going to be Apple or Android? Is anybody else going to get in? With the Internet of Things, there are vastly more manufacturers, and so they all need to find a way to get all of their gadgets to communicate with each other. And so we're seeing a bunch of big companies like Apple and Samsung and Microsoft all line up to have another big fight over who's going to be in charge of the way that all these gadgets talk to each other.
Okay, so far then, there hasn't been a consensus. We haven't had a moment when we know which ones we're going to get.
That's right. And to be perfectly honest, I'm okay with that. I would rather see a little bit of competition and, frankly, just it be a little bit hard because, you know, jumping right into a world where a single company is in control of the way that, you know, our door lock and our lights talk to each other does have privacy implications. And so it's probably better that it be a little difficult for a while so that we end up with a better solution in the end.
I don't want the lights whispering to the doorknob. It's not a good idea. So IoT is one acronym. What are some others?
Another one is ADAS, and I believe it's Advanced Driver Assistance Systems. I could be getting one of those A's wrong. But basically, all of the automakers out here at CES are showing off their ability to automate the car and turn it into a self-driving car. There's lots of self-parking cars. There's all sorts of smarts that they can build into these automobiles. And it's funny, we don't often think of cars as being something that can be automated, but that technology has advanced really, really fast. And, you know, the idea of a self-driving car is no longer, you know, 5 years out. It's coming very, very soon, and in many ways, it's already here.
Well, let's talk to somebody who has direct experience with that, and that is Alex Davies, who's associate editor of Wired. He's in charge of the transportation section there. Alex Davies, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How'd you get to Las Vegas?
So, actually, we made the trip from Palo Alto. Instead of leaving from SFO, we left from a hotel parking lot, and we made the drive in Audi's autonomous A7 sedan.
What does that mean?
So that means that this is a car that's built to drive itself at highway speeds on the highway. You know, it'll maintain its speed, it'll maintain safe distance from other cars, and it'll do everything that a human is trained to do, but a little bit better.
Tell us a bit more about the experience. How long did it take you not to want to grab the wheel?
So for the first 30 seconds where I let go of the wheel, I kept my hands probably within a few centimeters of it. And then after 3 or 4 minutes, after seeing it change lanes a couple of times and the way it kept its distance from other cars and really making some smart, calm decisions, I was totally calm. And then I spent the next hour or so in the car just sitting back.
I assume there was somebody there from the company with you?
Yes, we had Audi's project leader riding shotgun and always there to reassure me that, yes, the car knows what it's doing and that I could relax a little bit more.
Did you ever have one of those experiences that all of us as passengers have had that even though the driver might be doing something safe enough, it looks like trouble?
Do you know what? I really didn't. The car didn't do anything that I wouldn't do. In fact, it was the opposite. It wouldn't do things that I would do in some situations where I would feel comfortable making a lane change, even if it would be a little tight. The car just wouldn't do because it's programmed to be very, very cautious.
Did other drivers on the road or other passengers in other cars see what you were doing or not doing?
I did manage to scare one little girl who was riding in her family's SUV. It was the classic thing where a kid in the back of the car waves at you, and then I waved back at her with both hands. And that was, I think, the most exciting moment of this entire drive, was seeing her jump up in her seat. I think she thought I was a nut job.
So she noticed.
She noticed. I think for the most part, the car doesn't look like anything crazy. It did say self-piloted vehicle on the side of it. But other than that, you wouldn't be able to pick it out as anything special.
Okay, so the Audi A7 then is ready for the road. What's keeping it away?
So they'll need a few more years to iron out some kinks in terms of the way the computer is set up and ironing out decision-making kinks, but they're really very close to it. And some of the sensors the car uses need to make it from research grade into production. But that doesn't seem to be far away either. Right now, one of the biggest hurdles is figuring out the legalities of when the authorities are willing to let a car like this on the road. And California and Nevada, where we did the drive, already have legislation in place, but that legislation only allows testing of these vehicles. So Audi and other companies working on this will have to prove that this is indeed safe before they can actually start selling it.
At the Consumer Electronics Show, Mercedes also had a concept car. Describe that, and how different is it from the Audi A7?
Yes. So it's basically the opposite of what Audi showed off with its A7, which looks like a normal car, which only drives itself on the highway. Mercedes is showing us what these cars could look like, and I think a conservative bet is 20 years in the future. Wow. It's this totally bonkers, silver-looking thing. It's shaped kind of like a bar of soap, but a little sexier than that. And what it is a car that you wouldn't have to drive at all. And one of the big things about this shift to autonomous cars that I think we'll see in the coming decades is once the human no longer needs to drive the car, all kinds of basic design elements can be changed. You don't have to be facing forward anymore. So the Mercedes has car where the seats swivel around and you can feel like you're in a train car while the car does all of the work.
You can work on your computer or talk to somebody by not even looking at the road.
Exactly. You can be turned around 180 degrees away from where you're driving and theoretically feel very calm about it.
Alex Davies at Wired Magazine. Back to Dieter Bone at TheVerge.com. Is the Consumer Electronics Show then becoming all about cars?
It really is. I would say that I wouldn't say it's quite up to 50-50, but it's getting pretty close. And a lot of the most exciting announcements here came from car companies. Mercedes, as you just mentioned, had a completely ostentatious presentation. But we've also seen some pretty exciting things from BMW and Audi. And they've also been working with the electronics companies. And so in a lot of ways, CES is turning into a conversation between the electronics companies trying to sell their gadgets to the car companies, and the car companies trying to show off that they can play in this space as well.
So earlier you talked about what sounds like a sort of automatic house. Is that now a fact of life, and is the are the advanced thinkers moving into mobile applications?
I suppose, yeah. And in the same way that, if you go to buy a TV anymore, it just happens to have 3D in it, even if you don't want it. We're going to get to a place where if you want to buy, a light bulb or a smoke detector, it's going to have, this home automation stuff built into it, whether you want it or not. And then it's just a matter of getting it set up. And a lot of this stuff is built around the idea that you're going to want to control it from your phone. And so there's usually, the idea that your phone and an app on your phone is a central hub for, turning the lights on and off and switching other things. But it's going to be a mix of the stuff on your phone, but also the stuff in the cloud. The reason that the Internet of Things is happening in large part is because we figured out that we don't need to put an entire computer on, say, your toaster. You just need to put a little chip that's just got enough smarts to do a few things and then communicate to the Internet, and then you can have all the powerful processing happen in the cloud on somebody's servers. And so it's a mix of having a phone to control it, having a computer up in the cloud to do the heavy lifting, and then having some pretty cheap parts in the gadget itself.
Alex Davies with Wired. You said you got used to the automatic car pretty quickly, or the self-driving car pretty quickly. Do you really think there's a market for that? Do you think people are going to be able to overcome their initial concerns?
I absolutely think so. And I think one of the things Audi worked hardest on was making an interface with the car where it feels very natural to give over control. So when automated pilot mode is available on the highway, what you'll do is you'll hit these two buttons on the steering wheel at the same time. And then the steering wheel retracts a few inches away from you, close enough that you can still grab it, but far enough that it communicates this idea that, okay, the car is doing this now. And the fact that these things will come in as individual features, first Audi wants to put out a parking feature, then the highway a couple of years later, it'll give consumers time to slowly adapt to this. And it's the way people got used to adaptive cruise control. You try it out a couple of times, it's nothing that crazy, and then you get used to it.
Okay, we're out of time, but there is going to be an auto show in Detroit next week. Do you think, Alex Davies, there's going to be a lot of that there?
I think we'll see plenty more of it.
All right, well, thank you both. Alex Davies with Wired, Dieter Bohn with TheVerge.com. Great to have you with us.
Great, thanks.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, Pope Francis and the Catholic Culture Shock on To The Point.